Good morning.
Good morning.
So, there's a phrase from the Pali Canon when Buddha says, the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And what he's talking about is the inherent goodness of everything, of everything, of everyone, the inherent goodness. Ludwig Wittgenstein said, the miracle is not how things are, what they are, or why they are, but it is that they are. That they are. But a lot of us don't feel that way. A lot of human beings don't feel that way. We feel cut off. We feel isolated. We feel lonely. We feel discouraged. All that stuff. And of course, we grew up in Western culture, an original sin culture. And whether you were raised Unitarian or atheist, you grew up in an original sin culture for hundreds of years. Original sin culture says that we fell. We fell. And we're faulty and incomplete. And then society and communication becomes a vehicle for compensating for this incompleteness by struggling to keep up or get ahead or feel okay, right? Struggling. Outdo someone else, outdo ourselves, power, doubt. So I seem to be picking on my father these days because I talked about him last week too. He's really a wonderful person. He's dead, but he's wonderful. But anyway, after I started practicing, I've been practicing for a while, I went home and I told him about this quote, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And he said, oh, Tim, you are hopelessly naive. Hopelessly naive. Well, if you look around the world, look at how people interact, and look at politics, and maybe, you know, he had a point, right? He had a point. It's a toxic, there's a lot of toxicity in the world. A lot of toxicity in our human interrelationships and politically and socially. And inside of us, a lot of toxicity. But this is not, in Buddhism, luckily, due to sin, right? It's due to ignorance, to ignoring the fact that we're all part of this wonderful, seamless whole. In the first picture in the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination, it's the blind grandfather who closes his eyes and doesn't see that he's connected to everything, that he's part of everything, that everything is part of him, who then goes through 12 steps of getting all screwed up in the 12-fold chain, in case you know it or don't know it. So there's an ignoring of what's here. But luckily, even though it seems like there's a gap to bridge and that we're ripped out of the fabric of the universe, we are the fabric of the universe. We're it right now. Faulty or not faulty, we're it. It's here. So there's no gap to bridge. You don't have to be good to compensate for how bad we've been. Because it's here. It's here. There's no sin. There are no intermediaries we have to call on. You can call on Jesus and God and Buddha. That's cool, but you don't have to. Because there's no gap. There's no gap. There is suffering. And there are the causes for suffering. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But we can learn to deal with suffering skillfully. Skillfully. We can recognize our potential to live instead of blindly, wakefully. instead of no vidya, no seeing, with vidya, with calm and open vision in which we feel this and see this sense of communion. So what would happen if we all began to feel that we are innately good and let go of our self-loathing and let go of our self-aggression, our unworthiness? What would happen to society if everybody in this room did that? We'd have a little impact, wouldn't we? We'd have maybe a big impact. Maybe so. So our practice, our Zen practice, is to practice naked seeing. That's what we do when we sit on the cushion, and we try to do it when we're not on the cushion. Naked seeing, where we just open up and see what is. And last time I talked about the fact that in Buddhist psychology there are 75 perceptions that happen in every minute. 75 perceptions. So if we can just see maybe one or two of those without all of this tanglement, we're making a lot of progress. Without all this, you know, should have and should not have, and what did he do and what did I do and what should I do. Just see them. That's not ignoring. That's not ignorance. That's openness. And love comes out of that too, believe it or not. Love comes out of that. So, I read the New York Times a lot. I don't know why. I just do. I've been doing it for years. And some of these columnists are asking, is our social contract breaking down? Is it breaking down? We have a fundamental social contract, which is based on what our founding fathers set out to do. Even though they were white males, they created something which we now have tried to include others into, with checks and balances, and with compromise. But is our social contract breaking down? It reminds me of the play by Thornton Wilder, Skin of Our Teeth. Skin of Our Teeth. So it's a play that I like very much. So Thornton Wilder wrote that play in 1942. In 1942, my son-in-law's parents, as children, were hiding in the mountains. And my son-in-law's father was hiding with his father in the mountains in Switzerland because he was Jewish. And my son-in-law's mother had gotten out of Paris. They're Parisian, on the last boat before the Nazis took over. So in 1942, things did not look very hopeful. They did not look very hopeful. Well, I wasn't around, but I'm told they didn't look very hopeful. The Nazis had been in Paris for 2 years. They were exterminating Jews as fast as they could. As fast as they could. And so Thornton Wilder wrote this play, which is a good play. And now, I don't know. We don't know. Climate change is probably the worst of all. Thornton Wilder didn't know about climate change. But it's possible because we have this basic goodness. We have this, or it has us or something. We don't have it. We are it. Possible. Possible not to descend into chaos. Which reminds me of a quote by Trungpa Rinpoche, Tibetan teacher. He says, chaos should be welcomed as extremely good news. Chaos should be welcomed as extremely good news. What was he smoking? What was that guy smoking? Well, we know what he was drinking, but what was he smoking? But later he explained it. He said he was talking about chaos in the way that Greeks use it, which is actually the way that Taoists use it too, as a space of spontaneous openness and groundlessness that happens, that's there when things fall apart, when there's a potential in that space for new creation, for beginner's mind, for freshness. When you nearly crash your car, or nearly slip and fall, the mind loses its grip, and you're left in an open space. So we have an opportunity to reconnect with what lies under the chaos, which is basic goodness. So about a dozen years ago, I was driving in my car on a weekday, and I was broadsided in St. Paul by some teenager without a driver's license. And he broadsided me on the left and shattered my front windshield and bashed my car door in so I couldn't move. I had my seatbelt on. I was being good. I had my seatbelt. And talk about chaos. The police came. The paramedics came. A lot of people. This was in the St. Paul neighborhood where a lot of people around me. They pulled me out of the car, put me on a stretcher, sirened me to Regent's Hospital, and there I was in the ER, nurses and paramedics hovering around me on my back. And I looked at the tile on the ceiling. I looked at the tile. And they were just wonderful. And I felt a sense of connectedness with everything. They're lying on my back with all this stuff around me. I don't know anything about it. It's just how I felt. That's how I felt. Naked seeing. This is what we cultivate in our meditation. Naked seeing. So that we can then carry it over into our daily lives as much as possible without being very self-conscious about it. Just let it carry over itself. Don't be too self-conscious. Because then it's not naked seeing. Then say, I do naked seeing right. Maybe I better go meet with Ted and Tim both to see if I got it right, you know. You know, that's not naked seeing. Naked seeing is naked seeing. Right now. Right now. So when things seem bad, we look at what's going wrong. We recognize the chaos that seems to be descending. But instead of going into hopelessness, we pivot. We have the opportunity to pivot and touch our basic goodness, basic openness. So we have the term enlightenment, which means fully illumined. So we try to enlighten the difficulty, fully illuminate the difficulty. Pivot, open to it, and the solution to the difficulty is already here. But if you're looking for it, it's not always not already here. And you might have to sit with it for a long time. You've got to just do it. You just have to do it. So one of my favorite Chinese Zen prose poems is The Merging of Sameness and Difference. And the first two lines of that are, well, we used to chant that here. I don't think we chant it here anymore. We used to alternate chant it sometimes on Saturdays and sometimes during retreats. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the darkness there is light, but don't take it as light. So opposition between you and me comes up from our failure to recognize our undivided nature, our basic goodness. Nothing. We're all undivided. We're all flowing into each other continually. Darkness, light, up, down, left, right, sweet, sour, white, black, good, bad. Stuck. We got stuck on one of them. We got stuck. I think I said this last time. I don't know if I did, but How many more times do I have to Google Trump Russia the moment I get in the house? Wouldn't you say that was stuck? But if I can just see it, laugh at it, laugh with it, feel the pain of the worry, just be with it, I can settle into this spaciousness that's always here. But then the next time I come in, I'll probably do it again. That's the way it is. It's okay. It doesn't matter. So, how about Romeo and Juliet? How about Romeo and Juliet? So, Juliet says to Romeo, what's in a name? A rose by any other name would spell the same. And they're deeply in love. They're deeply in love. But because of their families and because of division between families, the Capulets and the Montagues can't hang out together. They have their stories, they've got their history, they've got their culture, and so on. Romeo and Juliet end up dying because of the bad will, the divisiveness between the Capulets and the Montagues. We end up killing people, killing ourselves when we get caught by these dichotomies, right? The Montagues and the Capulets rob each other of their humanity. They rob each other of their humanity. The tragedy is that Romeo and Juliet can't escape, and they're dragged in. Even though their love is fresh and heartfelt, they're dragged in, dragged down. But this is not as tragic as some of Shakespeare's tragedies, because in the end, in the very end of the play, after Romeo and Juliet are both dead, the Capulets and the Montagues come together. This awful experience of losing their loved ones, flesh of my flesh, brings them together. So they're good Buddhists. They don't even know it. It's better not to know it, right? And just to live it. They come together. They realize this naming and this separation that comes from clinging to this naming and all the stories about this naming causes tragedy continually. So it's Shakespeare's least tragic tragedy just because of that very end. At least somebody said that. I'm not an expert on Shakespeare, I'll tell you. I can't even hear Shakespeare anymore because of my hearing. I can only go to Shakespeare if they have open captions in the theater, and then I can watch the words. So they opened their hearts. If we open our heart, great sorrow can pass through. Like a wave rolling through the sea. They're great. We have a lot to be sorrowful about. Can we let it just pass through like a wave? It causes upheaval. But we don't need to act like a Montague or a Capulet, do we? We can let this emotional and mental turmoil rise and move through and not get all wigged out by it. That's possible. Possible. When tragedy strikes, it's like natural for us to want to close our hearts. I want to close my heart. This is scary. This is awful. And then we become, again, the blind grandfather, the blind grandmother, cutting off. That's fine. I mean, that's not bad. We're not bad. Remember, this is not original sin. You're not bad for doing this. You've just forgotten your original goodness, and you need to protect your little self for a while before you can open up. That's good. Protect your little self for a while. Just take care of him. Just take care of him. Just be with him. Just nurture him. Her. Whatever. instead of judging, just being open to whatever passes through. And there's room, a lot of room there for sorrow, joy, sadness, anger, hatred, love. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the darkness there is light, but don't take it as light. So, Zen practice is about discovering, attempting to discover and live from basic goodness. And how do we do that? Well, I'm going to turn to the Taoists, since we're studying the Taoists right now in our study group, to tell us how to do that. The Taoists say all we have to do is practice Wu Wei, doing non-doing. That's the whole deal. Practice doing non-doing. So this means engaging in activities for their own sake, without any ulterior motive. Spontaneous, fresh. And the blue-collar sages in the Chuangzi's realm, the Taoist realm, are artisans, butchers, craftsmen. They're blue-collar sages. And Bodhi will remember that when we were young and practiced together, all of our male friends with master's degrees and PhDs and almost PhDs became carpenters. Do you remember that? They all became carpenters. Because they wanted to become blue-collar sages. That was their aspiration. Now, whether they made it or not, I don't know. They just wanted to give themselves to simple physical activities, or their minds wouldn't get messed up. That was their goal. So I'm going to read... So those of you who are vegans might be a little sensitive to this story, but I'm reading it anyway, and you don't have to listen if you're a vegan. This is about a Cook Ting in Chongsa, Cook Ting. This is Cook Ting. At every touch of his hand, every heave of his shoulder, every move of his feet, every thrust of his knee, zip, zoop, Ting slithered the knife along with a zing, and all was in perfect rhythm. He's cutting up the ox, by the way. And though, as though he were performing the dance of the mulberry grove, or keeping time to the Ching Shao music. So when Ting is then asked by his student, because he's got students, he's really Taoist teachers in disguise or something, how he could achieve such skill, he said, "What I care about is the way, which goes beyond skill. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox itself. After 3 years, I no longer saw the whole ox. And now I go at it by spirit and don't look with my eyes. Perception and understanding have come to a stop, and spirit moves where it wants." Ting goes on to explain how this mastery is achieved. "Whenever I come to a complicated place, I size up the difficulties, tell myself to watch out and be careful, keep my eyes on what I'm doing, work very slowly, and move the knife with the greatest subtlety until, flop, the whole thing comes apart, like a cloud of earth crumbling to the ground. I stand there holding the knife and look all around me, completely satisfied and reluctant to move on. And then I wipe off the knife and put it away." That's Tao Zen Master Ting. So we see the elements of doing, non-doing in there, which are really Soto Zen practice. Clearly defined goal. Lots of people think, oh, in Zen you shouldn't have goals. Well, we're human. That's what actually, another article I read in the New York Times recently talked about how what separates humans from animals is that we conceive of a move toward a future. I don't know about the quality of their research, but I read that. So having a clearly defined goal, in this case, to chop the ox carcass with minimum effort and least wear and tear on the cleaver and on the chopper. Number two, completely immersed in the activity of butchering with no space for any thought or feeling. Number three, single-minded focus and intention. And then what happens when I come to a complicated place? When I come to a complicated place, I size up the difficulties. We need to size up the difficulties. We have an intellect. We shouldn't just throw out our intellect. Size up the difficulties. I need to tell myself to what to watch out for and to be careful. We need to do that because there's toxicity out there and in here. So we need to pay attention. We don't just cut our minds off. Use our mind too. Keep my eyes on what I'm doing. Work very slowly. When there's a difficulty. If you rush, you just get all tangled up. Very slowly. Slow is fast. If you just engage in it, it's. Don't worry. If you do it slowly, you won't have to redo it again. And move the knife with the greatest subtlety until flop. Flop. So, whatever the challenge is, whatever it is, we can develop a new skill by taking that challenge on. Fully engaging our body mind without worrying about results. And then even dancing to this famous Chinese symphony of the 3rd century before the contemporary era. I haven't looked it up. The Mulberry Grovers. and the Ching Shao music. I bet we could Google it and find out about it. Engaging. And not getting all like this is a big hard thing. Yeah, it's hard, but if you do it, you give yourself to it, you can dance with it. You may be awkward dancing. That's okay. Awkward's fine. He did awkward. He does awkward. So, Robert Pirsig, whose picture's up here someplace. Okay. Anybody see him? Is he on a motorcycle?
Next to him.
Huh?
He's right on the side. He's next to one.
Oh. Yeah. Is he on a motorcycle in that picture?
No.
No? All right. Well, anyway. Oh, yeah. So there's a picture of Robert Pirsig, not on a motorcycle. But we're here because of Robert Pirsig, in case you guys didn't know that, in this building. Because in 1975, after talk about Zen practice with no expectation. Supposedly, according to his wife Nancy and according to my friend Eric Storley, he sent that book to 100 publishers. More than 100 publishers. I didn't even know there were 100 publishers before anybody said they would publish. Good Zen practice. You just do it. You don't worry about the result. And then it got published, it became famous, and we were able to buy this building because he donated the money for the down payment to us. Huh. Wonderful. So Robert Pirsig says in the book, Zen and Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, when you're not dominated by feelings of separateness from what you're working on, then you can be said to care about what you're doing. That is what caring really is, a feeling of identification with what one's doing. So if we do this practice, whether it's with oxes, or with our cushion, or with our lives, or any activity, our lives begin to feel better. And we do tap in a little bit to some sense of basic goodness sometimes. A little bit and a little more. And we can even have what the psychologist, and I have such a hard time pronouncing his name, Csikszentmihalyi talks about the flow. We can experience flow. So you can see in Chuang-tzu how there's all this work that these blue-collar sages do, and then at some point they get into flow. They get into flow, which is the same for us. Same for us. And then when they get out of flow, when they're in a complicated place, they just come back and stay with it. And again, do it until they find the opening. They find the opening. So flow state, which this guy has talked about since the year 2000. Yeah, I don't think he read the Taoists, but it doesn't matter. Maybe he read them. Yeah, it's like he learned all this through research. Well, that's a different kind of research. That's fine. In the flow state, timelessness, security, growth beyond the body boundaries of ego, whether it's with a musical instrument, mountaineering, martial arts, yoga, sports, zazen, daily life, whatever. Whatever. So if we do this, then we have a chance to experience some deep happiness and love. Deep happiness. So this happiness that we settle into is finds us. We don't find it. Excuse me, I've got just a problem with my nose. I have an allergic nose this time of year. This happiness finds us. It finds us. When we do things that we can fully engage in and enjoy. Sometimes we don't think we're going to enjoy something, but if we fully engage in it, then we do end up enjoying it. Sometimes that's not the case. And then we should find things that we can fully engage in, rather than try to be some superior being. So too much effort devoted to being happy doesn't work very well, does it? It doesn't work very well. It makes us miserable. It makes us miserable. So, let's see. Maybe 35 years ago, I took my son to an amusement park in the San Francisco area, my hometown. And we went out there, and it was just him and me, and he was probably 11. And something like that. And this was my chance to do something with him. Because I had not been paying very much attention to him. And I wanted him to be happy, and I wanted to be happy with him. So we really planned it out ahead of time. My daughter wouldn't be there. She monopolizes all the time. And, you know, I have a natural heart connection with her, you know. So here, my son. I really wanted it. Really want us. So we worked together in planning the trip, planning the amusement park, all the things he wanted to do, working on it together, thinking it. And for some reason, we only had one day in the amusement park. And we went in the early morning, we had all planned out how and my son is good at this, mapping things. So he had, even at 11, he had it all mapped out. And we were so trying so hard to get along and be happy that everything got all bungled up. Rides took too long and the lines were too long and our map got lost and we got mad at each other. And I said, Jed, we can't do all 13 of these things today. It's already 2 o'clock. He said, Dad, you promised. I promised. I promised I would make him happy, and I would be happy by making him happy, God damn it. Right? So, the end of the day was finally over, and we didn't do all 13 things, and I felt guilty. But I had a chance to redeem myself last month with my grandson, who's 11. We went to the amusement park, not in California, but actually overseas on the other side of the ocean. And actually, I never thought about the first one. I didn't think about these two things until that they were similar, until I was preparing for my talk 2 or 3 days ago. So, but I thought, oh, that's interesting. So now, in my new grandfather role, which I've had for a while, it's much easier for me to practice doing non-doing. And just sort of hang out. So we did the same thing. We went through the same deal with my grandson, Ethan. Again, But I was not trying to make him happy. I was not feeling guilty that I was not had not been there for him, that I had to compensate for something. So I just went with him. We had a good time. I didn't worry about the results. And I wasn't worrying about the results. He wasn't worrying about the results, although he was still trying to go on all the worst rides. Worse from my point of view. And actually, I got kind of sick to my stomach once. And I said, Ethan, I gotta, you go on the next two yourself. But I had a wonderful time. We both had a wonderful time. So, doing, not doing. Doing, not doing. So what about love? Same thing, right? We can't try or will ourselves to love. We can do that loving kindness meditation 132 times. That's fine. We should do it. But we can't try or will ourselves to love. And when we do, it doesn't work. So I read something recently about marriages. And I was reading about arranged marriages. Indians in this country, still many of them do arranged marriages. The divorce rate with arranged marriages is very, very low, even though now divorce is pretty socially acceptable, like 1%. 1%. And my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law's parents are Indian, and their marriage was arranged. Our marriage was arranged, which seems kind of weird to us. And in a way, it is kind of weird. But over time, they discovered they could get along and developed a lot in common. And usually when they do these arranged marriages, the families make sure the socioeconomic status is somewhat similar. And they consult the astrologer. Of course, you should consult the astrologer. And they do these arranged marriages. So I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't think, but it's interesting. And you know, they're not thinking too much about love and finding the ideal partner. They're just given this partner. So a study was done of IKEA. I should know how you pronounce that. IKEA, right?
IKEA
furniture shoppers. And yeah, well, you know, these psychologists need something to do. They want to. It's hard for them to get tenure, and almost impossible these days. So they got to figure something out, something interesting to do. So this guy did work with IKEA furniture shoppers, and found that those who thought less about which furniture to buy were happier with it a few weeks later. Happier. So the negative consequence of thinking too hard is that we get attached to options, and then we have to choose one. Well, we're attached to all these other options. How can we choose? And then we have to choose one, and we have regret. So there's not too much doing, non-doing in there. But we can discover that. We don't have to get wigged out by all this stuff. Come back to doing, non-doing, so we settle into our basic goodness. We can do that. So a paraphrase of the Zen teacher Robert Aiken. He said, enlightenment is an accident. Practice, meditation practice, will make you accident prone. Well, how about happiness is an accident? Being open to new things, new experiences, new people makes us happiness prone. It's an accident. But we engage. We engage, and then it comes up. Then it comes up. Not directed toward achieving love or happiness, but just being ready. Just being ready. So in my second book that comes out next year, Shambhala isn't going to publish it for a whole year. I don't know what they do with these books. They accepted it some time ago. Anyway. But didn't you say that the book about Hojo-san isn't coming out for 2 years or something, Andrea?
Not quite that long.
Oh, okay.
From start to finish.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, since you won't see my second book for a year, here's a quote from it. This is about doing non-doing, Wu Wei. This is about meditation practice. It's sponge practice, I say in book number, my second book. The sponge exists by pumping water through its body. Water flows through its internal canals, bringing nutrients and removing toxins. Water may be too warm or too cold, but the sponge just takes it in and receives the nutrients that are offered. If the sponge becomes rigid and calcified, water can no longer flow through its canals. The trapped water becomes polluted, and the sponge dies. The sponge cannot live in isolation. It can't live in isolation. In meditation, we learn how to keep the water flowing. Sometimes the current brings sadness and loss. Sometimes it brings joy and prosperity. By staying open, even when the water is too cold or too warm, we can experience a natural communion with all that exists. The water inside the sponge is not separate from the melting Arctic ice sheet and Antarctic glaciers. It's not separate from the vaporized water in our atmosphere or carried by comets from other parts of the universe. It's the stuff of the universe flowing through a tiny, seemingly insignificant sponge. But how insignificant can it be if it is nurtured and nurtured and nourishes the entire universe? It is nurtured by and nourishes the entire universe. It stays alive by remaining open to its environment. Doing non-doing. That's how we tap into this basic goodness that's always here. That's how we reconnect with some intelligence that we have at the deepest part of our being, some intelligence. So rather than getting too hung up on me and Raymond, or me and Jeff, or me and whomever, I can settle into my lived experience as I am with Jeff, as I'm with Raymond, as I'm with each of you. If I do that, then basic goodness is presenting itself, just on its own. Just on its own. So, the Dharma is good in the beginning, the Dharma is good in the middle, and good in the end. So that's what I want to say for this morning, and we can have a little discussion if you would like. Or we can just sit here like sponges if you prefer. Anybody? Raymond.
What's your last name so we can look for your books?
Pardon?
What is your last name?
Burkett. Yes. That's
my... Looking for your books.
Oh, well, when my book is out there on the porch, I'll give you a cut rate. $14.99. The proceeds go to a good cause. Raymond.
I was just going to comment the study on IKEA.
Yeah.
There was a similar study done on salad dressings.
Salad dressing. Oh.
And they found that when people had too many options, because the average grocery store has over 100 different salad dressings, people shut down and they walk away. They can't deal with it. It's too much.
Oh, good. Yeah, good. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So be careful when you go in the lawns or wherever you're going to. Be careful. It's dangerous out there. Who else? What else? Jim.
When you were talking about love and the IKEA study, what was coming up for me was that it seems that expectation is what's jamming us up. I have this expectation of what love looks like, or how it manifests, or how, you know, what my furniture purchase is going to result in.
Yes.
That's
yes.
When we're holding on to
it. Yes.
This is what the results are going to be. That's when we're really going to hit.
That's right. Could you guys hear him? Could you hear him? No. Basically, what he's saying is that expectation jams us up, that we hold on for dear life when we're expecting something, right? You have anything, do you want to say something more aloud to these folks, or is that it?
That's a good summary, thanks. Sorry
okay.
I didn't speak up enough.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's right. That's right. And of course, and I say that a lot, that expectation jams us up. But the other side is that we need to have expectations. You know, we set goals. We work toward goals. But I always talk about if we can locate the aspiration in our heart and not be caught by the cognitive expectation, then we can be softer and more doing non-doing about it. Yes.
How do you reconcile the fact that we're all
Can you speak
good?
A little louder?
How do you reconcile the fact that we're all good with the fact that we all do not good things?
Yeah, so she says, how do I reconcile the fact that there's this basic goodness with all the evil things that we're doing all the time? Well, I don't reconcile them. It's just that the explanation is that we get caught in our need to take care of our small little self inside that feels threatened. And we get caught by that. And we create many, many problems when we magnify that through our thinking and our worrying and our fighting. Fighting with ourselves and fighting with each other. So that's why, the only way I know is to sit on a cushion and look at the wall. I mean, that's what I've been doing for my whole adult life. And it does work. But not if you get a solid, rigid expectation. You have to let go. And if we let go, at some point, we do feel communion with everyone. The Capulet then feels communion with the Montague and grieves how his selfishness, my selfishness, led me to diss my own 11-year-old son because I wanted him to be happy. I wanted him to be happy. Well, so we're selfish. We're a little selfish. So that's part of the whole deal. But we can always do it over again. If you don't have a grandson, you can have a grand dog. Do it with your dog. I mean, no, you can always do it because we're basically good. Everything is just this one process of wonderful inner flowing of life. Sure. Yeah.
I have to quote, there was this Minnesotan that came from a little north of here, from Hibbing.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of us really like his words.
Yeah. Oh, that guy.
Yeah, you know, very good sign of his My Back Pages.
Uh-huh.
Though he was not a Buddhist, he had the line, deceived me into thinking
Can you say that louder? Say the line louder.
Deceived me into thinking I had something to protect.
Uh-huh.
That's the song between the song My Back Pages.
Yes, yes.
He wasn't a Buddhist himself. He said some kind of Buddhist.
Yes. He's talking about Bob Dylan, whom I quote in here all the time. But that quote I don't know about. Would you say that again? Loud?
My Back Pages.
Yeah.
The line is, deceived me into thinking I had something to protect.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Jeffrey.
I think there's something missing, and that's not acknowledging and understanding our ancient twisted karma.
Uh-huh.
That's the path forward.
Well, yes, that's the path
forward. Looking at this room with primarily pale-skinned people sitting on land that was formerly occupied by Lakota Dakota people who were driven out of here by pale-skinned people next to a lake that was named after the enslaver of African Americans, and not acknowledging those facts and attempting to deal with them creates this problem in the world. That's my view.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. Not at all. Thank you.